I believe that our system, this DNS system, is one of the most notable systems out there, maybe Bitcoin being the most notable, and ours being a close second or third in terms of one of the most notable decentralized autonomous protocols that just runs and provides this public utility for naming.
Hello, welcome to episode 44 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I'd heard of Blockstack and been a follower of Ryan Shay on Twitter, but like so many projects in this space, I'd never taken the time to try to understand exactly what Blockstack is doing. If you're in the same boat as me, sit back and get ready to understand Blockstack. Here we go. Ryan Shay, co-founder of Blockstack, thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. So to get started, I'd love to know your background as early as you'd like to go in terms of your interest in technology or politics or anything that you think led you to where you are today.
So as a child, I always wanted to be an inventor. I went to school in Princeton and I studied mechanical and aerospace engineering and computer science. And when I was there, I actually met my current co-founder, Muneeb Ali. And we knew each other. I ran the entrepreneurship club there. Muneeb, he was doing his PhD in distributed systems. And years later, we met up in New York and actually decided to start a company.
You said since you were a child, you were interested in being an inventor. Were you inventing any things? Like what kind of stuff did you play around with?
Yeah, so when I was really young, I was so fascinated by every single building toy that I could get my hands on, from Legos to Kinex to Lincoln Logs to these like electronic sets that you could put together and build like robots and little machines that would go. And actually, I worked with my grandfather on these mechanical engineering puzzles. So he'd give me some tiny device to like redesign, and then I'd take a crack at it and see how I could actually, if I could figure out a good solution to the problem that he was presenting. So, for example, how can you design a switch that will trigger the flow of electricity automatically upon impact? And he actually has a patent on a device that was a pretty big breakthrough at the time. So he asked me to come up with it. So it's things like that. And I always loved puzzles like that.
Wow, that interest and that relative seems like a great thing for you, the way that turned out.
Yeah, and then that's partly what got me really into mechanical and aerospace engineering. And that's, I went into that, I loved it. But then eventually I fell in love with computer science. I love building things. I love building things in any form. I was fascinated by the physical world, and then I started getting more and more fascinated by the digital world. And I think one thing that really pushed me over the edge to go more digital was the idea that you actually have a lot more leverage in the digital world. You also have much tighter iteration cycles. And so there's more of the ability to take what's inside of your brain and convert it into reality, right? To manifest that. And as we're getting more and more screens in our lives, as we're getting greater capabilities in our phones and our computers, as VR and AR is starting to really take off, it is at this point where you can actually have very few hardware components and that are more generalized, and you have a much greater capability to write software that can run on top of that hardware. So I actually do believe that going forward, software is going to continue to be the greatest hotbed of innovation, and that is what excites me. That's really what got me into computer science and software initially.
Before you got started with Blockstack, did you follow up with any other kind of entrepreneurial ideas?
When I was in college, I ran the Princeton Entrepreneurship Club, and I had side projects. I had a startup at the time, and it was similar to what TaskRabbit is today. And I was working on that. And then right out of college, I had another startup, and that was doing analysis of social network data. And then afterwards, I came to New York, and I was working at a company. And after that is when I actually teamed up with Muneeb, and we decided to get the team right first. We decided to build a company and figure out what we were both interested in. So no exact plans on product, no exact plans on direction. Let's just figure out the team and then go from there. And after experimenting and building things with each other, we kept coming back to this idea that the web, the internet, the way that it's evolving is not headed in the right direction, and that we are actually running into a lot of problems today. We're running into a lot of problems in terms of security, in terms of safety, in terms of privacy, in terms of scalability, and that we need to do something in order to keep ourselves safe, to keep ourselves free, in order to ensure that innovation continues on the internet, that consumers have lots of choice, that consumers don't get locked into high prices that are being foisted upon them by monopolists. So in order for us to create a very prosperous society, it is imperative that we actually make sure that we achieve and push for decentralization. And that's really what led us to Blockstack.
I'm curious what year this was and also how that relates to when you first got into Bitcoin.
So Muneeb and I, we teamed up in 2013, summer of 2013. And we actually came out with our first prototype for OneName.com, which is our first product. We came out with that in March 2014. And I actually started getting into Bitcoin seriously right around when we started the company. So I believe we started it in June 2013, and that is right around when I got interested in Bitcoin. That was right after the Cyprus run-up, I believe. Yeah, I think Cyprus, what was that, like May, right?
Yeah, I got interested around the same time.
that's amazing.
What really got you into it, do you think? What was on your radar?
Well, first of all, I had known about Bitcoin, and I had heard about it earlier. In fact, I had a friend of mine who was telling me about it when I was in college, and right after college, the company that I was working on, it was, as I mentioned before, we were analyzing users' social graphs in order to give them insights about their social network that they could then leverage with the applications that they're using. In order to do this, we had some very intensive processing to do, and in order to do it, we actually required GPUs in order to crunch all the information. And at the time, one of the things that we were thinking of doing was repurposing the GPUs and the extra cycles for Bitcoin mining, but we never ended up doing that, which I regret. But I was vaguely intrigued by it already, but I hadn't really gotten deep into it. And then later on in 2013, May, June, I had a friend, Jonathan Silverman, who was really into Bitcoin, and he really pushed me on it. And seeing Bitcoin all over the news, seeing the news around Cyprus, and having him talk to me about Bitcoin every day, is really what pushed me over the edge. And that's when I fell in love and kept going deeper and deeper into it. And I was so interested in the idea that machines would be able to pay machines in the future, and that decentralized autonomous organizations would be a thing, and that you could have all of these interesting payout models and micropayments and decentralized protocols that could be layered on top. I was so fascinated by Namecoin. It was just this box that had been opened to me, and I couldn't stop digging deeper and deeper. And then by the time October came around, that's when Muneeb and I decided, you know what, we're going to build this decentralized application platform with its own decentralized identity system and decentralized naming system, and we're going to do it on top of the blockchain. And that's what got the whole system rolling.
Well, that's a pretty exciting goal. I've got to tell you, I've never taken the dive. I've, you know, heard pretty much nothing but positive things about you and Blockstack. I'm hoping you can explain it all to me right now in a way that everyone will understand the basics, hopefully by the end of our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Really what we're doing with Blockstack is we are taking a look at the internet. We're taking a look at how the internet has become so consolidated, how we're reliant upon a very small set of companies, and there's so many external dependencies. We essentially are reliant upon Facebook and Google and Amazon just to use the internet. And in a sense, they are the internet. The internet was meant to be an open, decentralized, free system. That's how it was designed. It wasn't designed to be, to have these gatekeepers that represent a very large percentage of the usage of a system. There's a lot of things that could go wrong with this. There are some concerns in terms of security. There's some concerns in terms of monopoly power. There's some concerns in terms of innovation and economic impact. At the end of the day, each of us, we want to be able to control our own experiences. We want to know that we're safe and are in control and free, whether it's on the internet or in any aspect of our lives, whether we're taking an Uber to go to a friend's house, whether we're renting an Airbnb and staying somewhere, whether we are buying some product and getting it shipped to our homes. It's very important for us to have safety and freedom. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring that entire experience to the internet and the rest of our lives. And as the world is becoming more and more digital, what that requires is that we actually wean ourselves off of the cloud and that we wean ourselves off of these digital fiefdoms that Facebook and Google and Amazon have built for us. In a sense, you can think of them as digital fiefdoms because they are the lords and we are the serfs. Now, that obviously sounds a little of an aggressive metaphor, but at the end of the day, when they are hosting all of our data, when our identities are completely defined by and tied to their systems, what that means is that we really aren't in control of our experiences on the internet. And that could be fine on a day-to-day basis, but when bad things happen, and as the number of hacks increase over time, and as the number of DDoS attacks go up, and as the number of dangerous things happen on the internet start to increase, it becomes more important for us to be in control of our lives, of our digital lives. And we can give people this application platform where you download this application and all of a sudden you have access to this new internet where you control your data, you control your identity, and the applications run just with you. There's no remote servers. There's no third parties or middlemen that you have to depend on. That's the vision. That's what we're trying to achieve.
I'm assuming your system could still have a social network even if everyone's running decentralized apps.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. There are people who are building social networks on Blockstack, a decentralized Twitter, for example. And even though consumers are running their own local nodes on the network, that does not preclude a social network from forming. So it just means that it's a peer-to-peer social network. I mean, we've seen federated social networks being built. You see Mastodon in the news a lot these days. It's like a federated Twitter. But peer-to-peer social network can totally exist. And the key to that is allowing each user to control their experience on their own local device and then helping users connect to one another so that they can discover each other's content.
And I guess I'll just take your other two examples just out of curiosity. I mean, you're talking about Amazon. They offer so many services. Are you talking about them as where we order our products? Or are you web services or everything?
Both, actually, yeah. So, I mean, there's a startup called OpenBazaar. They're built on top of Blockstack, and they use Blockstack for decentralized naming.
I was not aware they used you guys.
Yeah. So they're a decentralized eBay, and I believe that platforms like that's the future. They are the future of commerce. I mean, commerce is, I can't imagine 20 years from now that commerce is going to be on a single software provider on the internet. That just doesn't sound right to me. I do believe that there's going to be a decentralized protocol, marketplace protocol, and there's going to be many different clients that are built on top of that. And right now, the most promising effort for that is OpenBazaar. So I believe that decentralized commerce is extremely important. Decentralized social networks, very, very important. And then decentralized discovery. So some decentralized network will grow to compete in some way with Google. That's my prediction. I don't know exactly how, but they're going to, it could be some particular vertical, but you can imagine some system of players that are coming together to collaborate on building a search index and coming up with the best algorithms to rank the results, right? And there's no reason that this has to be done by a corporation. This can be done by a network. This can be done by thousands of engineers who are collaborating around the world, who are not even affiliated in the same company. So I do believe that's another big opportunity.
I love the idea of the kind of competition that this would bring. It's hard for me to wrap my head around like who wins in this situation, but
yes,
it's cool to get to see the chance for individuals.
Yeah.
When you talk about coming together to kind of replicate what Google does, would people be doing this altruistically, or would there be some kind of a motivation of profit to help spur their work along?
I think you have to have profit motives. If you don't have profit motives and you have altruism, you can have certain outcomes. You can have very modest outcomes. I think that's what we've seen with open source software today. But, and even then, they're usually coupled with some other profit motive. So Facebook working on React, Google working on Angular, MongoDB having their open source offering and then having their paid offering on top. A lot of the most successful open source projects have people with business models on top, right?
Yeah, I'll find out about yours hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, here's another good example, right? There's Linux and then there's Red Hat. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the core has to be monetizable, but generally there is a lot greater strength when there is financial incentives. You can do a lot more when there's the money in it and when people are dedicating their livelihoods to it because they have incentive to.
I'd be real curious, how does it work with a decentralized search engine where there would be the profit motive, yet it's not too similar to like a big corporation? How does that work?
In order for this to work, there has to be some way to measure contributions, and there has to be a way to provably distribute compensation based on those measured contributions.
Okay.
And this, it's unclear to me exactly how this will be built, but I can guess. And I do believe that protocol tokens will play a very important role in this. So you can think of Bitcoin as a protocol token, Ethereum as a protocol token. We have Zcash. We have a lot of the protocol tokens being built on Ethereum, like Golem, like Augur, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these protocol tokens allow for the ability to actually have many, many different players work together. And if the tokens can be meted out according to some rule set based on contribution, then you have a system that can operate in a decentralized way. This is just one example.
As you say that, it sounds almost exactly what Adam Levine tried to do with our Let's Talk Bitcoin network, coming up with one of the early counterparty tokens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Trying to reward everybody. That certainly seemed to be real similar to what you were describing. So,
would you do it again? Would you try? Because it seems like the token space is very strong at the moment.
Well, it really makes sense. I mean, just having done whatever entrepreneurial work and having people contributing, not always having money, what a great way to have everyone kind of vested, where if it succeeds, everyone's already clear what they're getting. And it's, I like the idea.
Yeah, I mean, there are other models that don't involve tokens. You could have, if you have a way to have payments that can be provably fragmented amongst members of a project, like a Prism, you have an address where a payment goes to the address. And let's say there's 100 contributors, each with that are doing 1% of the work. You can have the payment that goes to the address be fractured into 100 pieces and then forwarded onto those other addresses. This is just another idea.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, I could totally see that too. I guess the fun thing with tokens is you could trade your ownership before it's really clear what the value is.
Yeah, yeah. It could happen with tokens and it could happen without tokens. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. Like in the second example, that's not a token, but it's a payment model.
You're a Bitcoiner, but you have the iconic Bitcoin keychain? Support this podcast and own the Bitcoin keychain you've probably seen hundreds of times on sites like CoinDesk, Bitcoin Magazine, Ars Technica, Vice, Popular Mechanics, Engadget, and many, many more. Just go to btckeychain.com. That's btckeychain.com. So I don't even know if you think it's possible to kind of explain to a layman how Blockstack works, how decentralized applications would work. Do you want to give it a try?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Before the internet, we got software on a CD-ROM, put it in our computer, and then it would run. Before the internet, software was pretty much on our computer, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately now, or fortunately, it depends on, there's benefits. At the moment, a very large percentage of our software isn't actually running on our computers. Our devices are just dumb terminals, and we are connecting to servers in the cloud somewhere else, right? We're connecting to data centers in, basically, we're connecting to Amazon's data centers or Facebook's data centers, and there's a lot of processing that's going on there. And we've moved away from a model where the software runs on our devices to a model where, well, there was just some of the software that runs on our devices, but a lot of the software runs elsewhere. And in order for us to do that, we need to connect to those servers elsewhere. If we lose access to the internet, our software doesn't work at all, right? You ever try to, if you're using Slack, you get disconnected from the internet, all of a sudden you can't even chat with your coworkers, even though you might be able to send them a packet over your network if you're on the same Wi-Fi network, right?
Okay, I like that example.
Yeah. If you think about it, it's a little strange that you can send data from one computer to another in your office because you're on the same Wi-Fi network, but you can't use any of your software. You can't use Slack, so you can't communicate with each other. You can't work with code because GitHub requires the internet, so you can't program. You can't use Google Docs or Google Drive. You can't work with these spreadsheets online and collaborate, but you do have a channel to send data to one another between your computers. It's a little strange. Why is it that if you and I are in the same room and we're in the same Wi-Fi network, we have our computers right next to each other, why, in order for us to collaborate on Google Sheets, for example, the data has to go from you to Google to me? And by the way, when it does that, it has to travel long distances and go through many, many intermediaries. It has to rely upon, has to go through many, many different computers. You have to trust your internet service provider and many other internet service providers. And you have to trust certificate authorities. And you have to trust these companies that are running the domain name system and content delivery networks and so many other entities that you don't even think about.
I'm with you.
Why can't we just collaborate together? Why can't you and I just connect and have our changes synced between our computers?
Gotcha. So in these examples, yeah, it seems really clear. It'd be great to be able to communicate directly whenever possible.
Exactly. And if we can do that, then that gives us this self-sufficiency. It gives us this independence, and it means that there's a whole host of security concerns that we can just not have to worry about. Because in that case where the internet's disconnected and we're just collaborating on our Wi-Fi network, all the data is staying in our office, not even leaving. That's pretty remarkable.
I don't know if it's because I'm a lot older than you. I don't know if I've switched to the cloud as much.
So what do you use?
Because I'm a freelance guy and nobody I do work for is a Slack person. The only time I used Slack was actually with Let's Talk Bitcoin when it was real active on what was going on with the network. And I hate when I'm pushed to use, you know, like the web version of Word, which I only use because people send me Word documents.
So, I mean, yeah, you bring up Word. Essentially what we're doing is allowing you to run all your software like you run Word locally, right?
Sure.
The cool thing about Word is that you can turn off the internet and so you can still use Word. So with Microsoft Word, it's one player. It's just you. So it's very clear how that's possible. Now, if you think about, okay, well, if there's something like Facebook or Twitter or some communication tool, maybe we can use a simpler communication tool as an example, why can't we Skype each other from different rooms in the same office?
Yeah.
That's an example of a multiplayer application, right? I like to think of it. Single player application. We've had single player apps that run only on a device for a very long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have multiplayer applications that can run only on our device and that can connect, allow us to connect directly with each other. So what we're trying to do is allow people to use all of their applications in this way, in a way that they could conceivably not have access to the internet. And I just use this as an example to demonstrate how there are no intermediaries and no trusted third parties, no servers halfway around the world that you are connecting to, right? In a way that you could just turn off your internet and communicate with people on your same Wi-Fi network. And the way that that works is that you download Blockstack, you download this, what we call a browser portal. And you download the browser portal, and all of a sudden, on all of your browsers, you have access to this new decentralized internet. And it comes with a dashboard, and you can see all of your applications. And when you click on an application, it loads up directly in your browser, and that application runs locally. And if you do that, and I do that, and we're friends with each other on this application, then I can send you a message and it'll get sent directly to you and won't require any other third parties for the message to go through.
We're not talking about changing current protocols that this is all running on top of. We can start doing this right now.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay. So that was my big, I guess, misconception on what was going on at Blockstack. So
we're not changing lower level protocols of the internet. We are introducing a new domain name system that can allow for very secure loading of the applications. And also, these names can be used as usernames on our system so that you and I can, if we know each other's usernames, they're securely tied to digital keys so that we can... each of our computers can know how to encrypt and decrypt information for each other.
I guess go back to the Blockstack browser, basically. If someone downloads that, what's available right now for them to use?
So we have yet to release the Mac and Linux versions of the browser portal. Right now we have, if you're a developer, you can use an early version of it. You can build it from source on Mac or Linux. And you can just get started. So if you're interested in developing, you're a developer, go to our GitHub, github.com/blockstack, get the browser portal, run it locally, and then do one of our tutorials. And you can go and do the Hello Blockstack tutorial, for example, and this will walk you through building one of these applications that utilizes the Blockstack decentralized identity system and authentication system.
I guess if they're on Windows, are there actually some apps that people could use?
We're not on Windows yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That was the last one. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's gonna be number three.
Okay. So like I was missing. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. No problem. Mac and Linux are coming up soon.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then Windows doesn't have a timeline for that yet, but we are going to come out with a timeline.
There's the identity and
identity authentication.
Yeah, and the name. So I guess those are kind of tied. Explain it however you think can kind of help me understand both.
On the internet today, I mean, you have an identity with Google, you have an identity with Facebook. And what they do is when you, let's say you log into an application with Facebook or Google, you are relying upon Facebook to relay your information and your information only. You're relying upon Facebook to essentially follow the rules correctly they can say, when you log into an application, they can say you are whoever they want. So in a sense, you're not in control of your identity when you're with them. They can release your information to anyone they want as well. So in a sense, your identity is defined by them and is completely tied to them. Now, what we're introducing is an identity system where there's no such third party that defines who you are. Instead, you define who you are. What that requires you to do is you need to download software onto your computer and eventually your mobile device. And that's where you hold your keys. These digital keys that give you access to your identity. If you lose these keys, you do lose your identity. But if you hold onto them and you're the only one who can hold on, you're the only one who has them, then it can be determined for certain that you are who you say you are. With the caveat that you have these additional verifications. But it can be determined for certain that you, not the exact Rob Mitchell, but like this particular user number 30952, right? Mm-hmm. When user 30952 comes back later, it can be certain that that person is the same person. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So not getting into the human verification side of this.
And that's just not something you're going to take on, or we're just not discussing it at this point?
Well, with that, the first important problem to solve is entity persistence. That means that the dog you saw 2 minutes ago is the same dog that you see today, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know anything about the dog's history. You don't know the dog's name, but you know what that dog looks like. And seeing the dog again in the same office, you can just assume that it's the same dog, right?
Okay. And I guess you just let the other party know whatever information is relevant and that's all they ever know?
Yeah. And the equivalent on the internet could be, let's say, an anonymous Reddit account, right? For an example. Let's say there's an anonymous Reddit account and their username is just numbers. And that Reddit account posted something. You know nothing about this account. They come back a week later. They post again. You can compare the number and see, oh, this is the same person that posted this before, right? This has absolutely nothing to do with characteristics about that person. You have zero information about that person. But what you do know is the person who posted a week ago is the same person as the person who posted just now. Right? These are two sides of identity. One side is entity persistence, and the second side is the bundle of attributes, right? The things about this entity.
So if we are choosing to go this way and join some kind of a social network that's powered by Blockstack or order some products through an app on Blockstack, then mm-hmm. we'd share our address maybe, or maybe we'd share our names or different things like that. And I could see over time, just like say your Facebook account, that's, that's if someone takes over and, they can really wreak havoc in your life.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm always really curious just because I'm paranoid and I don't know, just enough to be scared.
Well, that's okay. I mean, only the paranoid survive, right?
So how does it work? Again, I'm just with, people figuring out all kinds of new ways to, find cracks in our really complex systems with our hardware and software and everything. I mean, what kind of measures do you take to make sure someone doesn't steal some core private key or something that controls your identity and takes over your identity?
You start out, you have very basic levels of security, and then we nudge you over time and we help you build up greater and greater security over your account. And that comes in multiple forms. Part of it is multiple devices. So you can have a key on your computer, have a key on your phone. You can have a backup key that's encrypted in the cloud. You can have a key that you've written down on a piece of paper. And eventually you can have keys that you share with your friends. And all of these different factors form a constellation that allows you to gain access to your account. The goal is to develop a system where any particular key compromise, or even if two keys are compromised, you're still safe. And you can still access your account.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah. If you're familiar with Bitcoin multisig, it's very similar. And we do utilize Bitcoin multisig. We also utilize other things, like Shamir secret sharing, for example.
Okay.
So the idea is just making sure that you cover for many different situations. And if you think about, oh, well, I lost my phone and my computer, the user should still be able to recover from that. Okay, like, oh, well, now I have malware on my computer, the user should be able to recover from that. And so it comes down to setting up. And our systems for this are fairly simple at the moment, but they're getting more sophisticated over time. And we do have plans for getting it better and better. I think a big part for those users who are sophisticated enough too is hardware wallets. So if you can use a Trezor or a Ledger, for example, then this can help give you additional, or a YubiKey, this can give you additional account security.
Today's magic word is over. O-V-E-R. As in LTB Network, magic words are effectively over. You can still enter the magic word in your account to signal you listen to the show, but there are no further LTB coin rewards that I'm aware of. I don't know. So is there anything really interesting about what you're doing with naming, or is it
totally? Yeah. So we have a full-fledged decentralized domain name system. It's called the Blockstack Naming System, or BNS. And to fully appreciate what we've built with this system, it's important to understand some things about the domain name system. That essentially the domain name system was built with no security.
Right.
It was built in the most ridiculous way. It's essentially built in a way that, DNS lookups aren't secured, right? So you are asking some server somewhere about, hey, I want to find the IP address for this name. Google.com, CNN.com. What's the IP address? So you send a request to the server. The server can lie to you, by the way. Also, anyone in between you and that server can lie to you. So that's a problem. What we do is we couple DNS with certificates, right? So with SSL TLS. And you can get a certificate for your site, and that allows you to bind a key to a name. So that when you send a request to a website, you can know that you're talking to the right site because you can check the signature and verify the signature against the key and verify the key against a signature from what's called a certificate authority. And that lets you place trust in the identity of this website. Now, with these two things together, this is like it's a band-aid, first of all. It's a fix to a broken system. It can work. It's workable. But unfortunately, there are a lot of vulnerabilities here because the way that this system works is it relies upon trusting all of these top-level certificate authorities. It relies upon, because at the end of the day, any one of these root certificate authorities has the ability to say that any particular site has any particular key. That means that you have dozens and dozens of companies that can lie about who anyone is on the internet at any time.
It's more than dozens, right? Isn't it like hundreds or thousands?
Yes, you're correct. I mean, there is also a root certificate authority list that is bundled with operating systems and browsers. And that root is on the smaller order. But yes, the larger list, which actually has a decent amount of power, is in thousands. So yes, that's very, very, very unfortunate that we're in this situation where, look, our trusted base for identity of websites is enormous. Any one of these organizations could lie, could go rogue, could be hacked. And any particular site on the internet could be completely compromised. And you could be connecting to the wrong site, right? Which means that you can be phished. You can have all your information stolen. You can be completely hijacked. On top of this, people have built systems like certificate transparency, certificate pinning. People have tried to fix DNS with DNSSEC. It's an acronym for DNS security. And there are so many different efforts. It works for the most part, but it's not a great system. And partly due to the fact that the core design is flawed. And what we've done is we've said, look, how can we build a system that is secure by default, where every individual user has the ability to register a name and permanently tie it to a key, to a certificate, and permanently tie it to routing information, like IP addresses or the directions to a particular computer? And how can you do it in a way where only that user that registered that name has the ability to change the key associated with it? So that when you talk to that website, you always know that that data is being signed and encrypted by the right keys. You can be certain that you have a secure connection, right? So what we've done is we built that, and we've not only built it like that, we've built it in a completely decentralized way, where there's no organization that runs it. I mean, it just runs on top of the blockchain. We have a functioning system that runs, just a service, this public utility that is being provided to the world that runs without anyone running it. Like, there's no person that's running it. It's very similar to Bitcoin, how Bitcoin is a financial system that just runs without any central authority. And I believe that our system, this DNS system, is one of the most notable systems out there, maybe Bitcoin being the most notable, and ours being a close second or third in terms of one of the most notable decentralized autonomous protocols that just runs and provides this public utility for naming.
Is there any kind of a fee associated with claiming a name in this naming system?
Anyone can create a namespace, and there's a fee for that. And the reason for that is the fee is doesn't go to anyone. It's just sacrificed. Just sacrificed to the network, as in you destroy Bitcoins.
Uh-huh.
And these fees are required in order to prevent domain name squatting.
That was my second question. Okay.
Yep. And so, because if everything's free, then someone would just register them all instantly, right? So you just make a fee to register a namespace. But once you create a namespace, you can set the rules of that namespace. And you can say, like, hey, look, I want all names to cost $10. Or you can say, you know what, I want really short names to cost $1,000 and really long names to cost 10 cents. On our system, you can have the name Rob Mitchell on the namespace .id, robmitchell.id.
So it's somewhat similar to our current system.
Very similar to our current system, yes.
And you'd mentioned storage. Is this kind of like, you know, storage or MadeSafe or something like that?
No, we've actually taken a very different approach.
Okay.
So storage and MadeSafe and Filecoin and is there one more?
Sia,
yep, exactly. All four of those, they are decentralized storage systems where you have this network and you can put in a file and get other people to seed your files, right? Other people can host copies of your files. We decided to not go that route. Instead, what we did was we built a storage plug-in layer, a bring your own storage system. And the way that works is you plug in whatever storage provider. Every user hosts his or her own data, right? You host your data, I host my data. And what you do is you plug in your storage providers and decide where you want that data to go and to be hosted. So, for example, you can say, I want my data to be stored in two places. I want it to be stored encrypted on Dropbox, and I want it to be stored encrypted on IPFS Filecoin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also say, oh, I want two more. I also want it to be on Amazon Cloud Drive, and I want it to be on Saya, right?
Okay.
And now you have four backups for your data. And every other user does the same thing. And then when I want to load your profile, what I do is I look up your name on my local Blockstack node, and then it resolves it to your routing information, which contains references to where your storage providers are located. And then it goes and looks them up and grabs the file, and I load it and I see your profile.
Okay, it's funny, because when I think of storage, I just think of storing my own files for myself, not sharing them.
Well, if you only cared about storing your own files, wouldn't you just put them on your computer? And like, wouldn't you use a backup service or something?
Well, that's what I was thinking of, as a backup service, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I think of the more interesting part of storage is, I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to need your files to be used by multiple, let's say it's not even multiple users, multiple apps, right? And you might need to have data that's processed. You might have medical records that you want to share with a particular electronic medical record system, right?
Okay.
You're going to have permissions around your data, and you're going to have to manage who and what gets access to that data.
Got it. Okay.
So all of those things together encompass storage.
Gotcha.
Storage is where your data is, how it's accessed, who has access to it, how you control everything. All of that is bundled together in storage. And so what we've decided to do is we've decided to give you the most optionality when it comes to your storage, and to allow you to bring your own storage and to choose where and how you want it to be stored. So that means that you can use Amazon S3 or Amazon Cloud Drive and get all of the amazing, unparalleled reliability of these cloud systems. And you can also have a copy on one of the other decentralized storage systems that we talked about before to give you additional properties, to give you access across multiple geographic locations, and et cetera, et cetera.
Gotcha. Okay, I got you now. We haven't really talked about how this all ties in with the blockchain. You want to tell me about that?
Yeah. So we have all of the different layers of our system. The only layer that utilizes the blockchain is the naming layer.
Okay.
Everything else is off the blockchain. The naming layer is also a discovery layer, is also a key distribution layer, right?
Mm-hmm.
As we touched on before, the storage layer is dependent on this naming, discovery, key, distribution layer. The identity system is as well. The authentication system as well. So in a sense, this layer is the core layer. It is the entry point to, if you're ever going to refer to any user or any application or any file, you're going to utilize the naming layer. Just think about how you use the web today, right? Links. The web is all about links. It's about URLs. Links are king, right?
Sure.
It's the only way that you can accurately reference something. So that's where this whole thing comes in. That's why it's the backbone of the system.
So if I'm going to contact you, whatever your name is, we just verify it on the Bitcoin blockchain as something permanent to prove that this is you? Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what we really need is we need an association between a name and a key and some amount of information. Like, let's say in the case of an application, it could be an IP address. And in the case of a user name, it could be a URL to where a profile is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that association needs to be securely made. And we use the blockchain for that. What we do is we actually embed these operations into transactions in the blockchain. And Blockstack is blockchain agnostic. What our philosophy is to is to operate on as many blockchains as possible, of course, but whenever we can, rely upon the most secure and stable blockchain by far. And in that case, right now, that's the Bitcoin blockchain.
But the same data is existing on other blockchains too?
No, it's more like parallel systems on other blockchains. So like you can have .com and .net on the traditional internet, right? You can have maybe .com on one blockchain and .net on another blockchain.
And the user can just choose what they want to?
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay.
Yep.
With the current schism with Bitcoin that includes a possible fork into two branches, is there a way you guys kind of try to prepare yourself for any outcome? Or does it matter? How do you look at this dilemma?
We're actively watching the situation. I personally believe, you know, I'm pretty optimistic. I don't think I wouldn't be alarmed just yet. I think a lot of this is just talk. A lot of this is brinksmanship. You know, people are trying to throw their weight around and show what power they have in order so that they can get their way, which is really unfortunate because I think it scares the community a little bit. But I think it's just posturing. At the moment, I am not very scared that there will be a split.
Mm-hmm.
If it does happen, then we will have a discussion with our community. We will listen to what the community says and figure out which one they are most interested in following. We don't want to be involved in politics. At the end of the day, Bitcoin, you know, it's a decentralized system. We're running a decentralized system. It's not up to us to decide which system. I mean, at the end of the day, Blockstack is going to continue running on both forks. We will rally the community. We'll support what the community wants. We will go in the direction that most people are going, and then we'll pour resources into that direction, if such a fork ever does happen. And if it does, I do believe that there will be convergence. There will be some consolidation on one side or the other.
Okay. And the last question I have about Blockstack is just curious. I mean, it's Blockstack Inc. How does your role work with, you know, developing this whole new, do we call it a protocol? Is that the right word?
Yeah. I mean, there's a series of protocols. I guess it's a network. It's a new system.
So how do you guys get paid either now or down the line, or what's your business model?
Right now, we're not focused on the business model. We're actually really focused on building the system.
Mm-hmm.
The way we look at this is that this is either going to grow or it's not. If it doesn't grow, it's not even worth thinking about, or we should have poured more into getting it to grow. And if it does grow, then there will absolutely be business models that make sense over time. And that could be that could involve freemium software. That's a very obvious one. But the open source core software will always be free and open source, and we can always provide additional services on top of that. But for now, it's really, really important that we focus on just building the community, building out the system, getting as many people on board as possible, and helping this thing grow.
Do you guys have funding, or is this just all on your own dime, or how's that?
Yeah. So there's the open system, and then we do have a company that is the largest contributor to the protocol.
Okay.
For a better term.
Uh-huh.
So our company is funding. We raised $4 million back in January, and we had raised $1 million 2 years before that from Union Square Ventures, from Naval Ravikant, from Shauna Fisher and DCG and Lux Capital. And we raised that money so that we could put enough resources into the protocol and put it into the community and get it started and grow. But there can be other companies that are contributing to the system and that have just as much stake in the system as we do. It's not like the software is owned by us or anything, right?
But you guys are probably some of the biggest experts.
Yes, exactly. We have a similar situation with where we have Zcash, and there's the Zcash Foundation or something, Zcash Electric Coin Company. There's many companies that can be built on top of Zcash, but there's one company that employs the greatest experts on Zcash, and they contribute and they keep going, plowing back into the system.
Gotcha. I don't know if you feel like talking about just a few current events in Bitcoin right now. It might be tough to answer any questions if you're trying to be agnostic, but do you feel like it?
Yeah, sure. I might have to abstain if it's a question that I don't.
What if we go real general and just ask you, what other projects in this space excite you?
I'm really excited about OpenBazaar. I think it has a ton of potential as an open commerce platform. Really intrigued by Ethereum. You know, there's a lot of concerns that I have with Ethereum in terms of the issues they face, but very interesting. A lot of interesting things being built on top of it.
What would you say are your biggest concerns about Ethereum?
I'm concerned about remote code execution. I'm concerned about the scalability of the general philosophy of putting a large amount of logic on the chain. But I think it's been a great platform where there's a lot of prototyping going on, right? There's a lot of interesting new things that people are building that you might not have seen before, right? So in the short term, while there's not that many security challenges, and there's not many users of these applications, perfectly fine to build some of these prototypes that don't necessarily need to scale or be super secure at the moment. But like in terms of interesting new capabilities, Ethereum's has some good stuff going on there. Another one I was going to say, I really like IPFS and Filecoin. I think they're really cool. Really like Lightning.
And just to go back to Ethereum, because I do realize, mm-hmm. because I'm not a developer, I'm not really attuned to the technical aspects of Ethereum so much. But, you know, what hits me in the face all the time is the price appreciation.
Sure.
From the ICO to what it is today. And I guess it's interesting just that there's two completely separate halves to Ethereum, kind of the financial aspect, and then what really I guess is supposed to be going on is the technical aspect.
Yeah, I know.
I guess you could love one and hate the other, or vice versa.
Yeah.
I really only use Skype to do these interviews, and I saw Fluffy Pony was online, who was my last interview, and
nice.
Said I was about to interview you, and I said, you got any questions? And he said, what's your favorite altcoin, and why is it Monero?
Ha! Wow.
I'm going to change that a bit, but just are there any altcoins? I mean, you spoke about Ethereum. Is there any other altcoin projects that you are interested in?
I like Zcash a lot. I think it's pretty cool.
Uh huh.
I mean, I don't. I like it. I like all this stuff. It's very interesting. Really, what I'm kind of thinking is there's a lot of projects out there that are they're not really bringing anything new to the table, or they're just random projects. No reason to get involved in those. But I think what's important is things that are bringing genuinely new, important, useful utility.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I would say that we're really pushing on helping developers get started with apps on our system. You know, we have the new tutorial that we just released, just came out, and we're going to be coming out with new other tutorials as well. And I just invite people to check out blockstack.org and learn about what we're doing. Always happy to chat. We have a Slack. You can message us and check it out and invite you to join the community. So
at this point, is it pretty much just developers who can really participate? Is there a place for people like me?
I mean, yeah, users can absolutely come in and get started. I would say it's primarily for developers because a lot of this is very raw at the moment. You're welcome to come in and use the software, but I'd just be like, there's a little bit of a user beware, right? But we're working towards a wider release soon. So for like more consumer friendly release.
What's a theoretical timeline for, I guess, next stages and user adoption and all that kind of stuff?
We're focused on
just building the tools.
Yeah, just build everything out. I mean, we're gonna have a official developer release this summer, and regular users really will be able to use it. It should be in good enough shape for some tech savvy users, but we don't want to officially bless that until a later date because we do understand that outside of the most tech savvy Bitcoin and cryptocurrency Ethereum kind of users, there's still a lot of things that people might not be as familiar with. A good example is a lot of these systems require users to write down a 12-word seed. I consider that to be an alpha feature, mm-hmm. right? That is a little bit of a pretty heavy requirement to put on a user. So that's something that we would feel comfortable in a developer release, but we want a better key backup system for example, a more wider consumer release.
What's easier than that? That's safe. How does that work?
As I mentioned before, it'd be a combination of a lot of factors, but it involve, hey, you have your computer, your phone, maybe connecting the system to inviting a couple of your friends to help you back up the key, something like that.
Gotcha. All right. And so I know you're on Twitter. What's your Twitter name?
It's Ryan E. Shea. That's S-H-E-A.
And are there any other social platforms you want to give your information about?
I'm at Ryan on Blockstack. Ryan.id. That's my name. Mm-hmm. And I'm also Shea256 on GitHub. You can check me out there. And our GitHub is github.com/Blockstack.
Great. Well, I knew almost nothing going in, and now I feel like I have a pretty decent idea what you're trying to do without really knowing the technical stuff. So I think mission accomplished.
I'm very happy with how this went, and I'm glad that we could connect more on this, and really appreciate you having me on.
And no ICO or nothing, huh? Nothing like that?
I mean, does everyone have to ICO?
No, it's kind of cool that it doesn't sound like you're really trying to pump much except for this cool project. So
we're focused on the technology, yeah.
It sounds like it. Thanks for being on the show.
Great. Thanks, Rob. Really appreciate it. BitToy.
I hope you enjoyed learning about Blockstack from co-founder Ryan Shea. You can find links and show notes for this episode at thebitcoingame.com. Just look for episode 44. Leave a comment on this episode's show notes page, and I'll choose one comment to receive a free Bitcoin keychain. I'm The Bitcoin Game on Twitter, and you can email me at rob@thebitcoingame.com. See you next time.